Thank you very much. Thank you for this invitation. And in fact, I will talk about reptilian cortex, but other animal species, since the theme of what I would like to talk about is not only something about neurons, but something about the approach that I would argue in favor of, which is to multiply the number of model systems in our experimental approaches so that we can extract from these comparisons principles rather than a mass of details about implementation. And so this talk is about trying to find similarities between basic principles of the dynamics of neural circuits. And for this, I'll present work, experimental work that we've done in three different model systems. And as you'll see, they're completely different model systems. But the underlying dynamics that one seizes them, I will argue, is potentially very similar and might be a basic principle of neural function. So there are two basic features about the approach that we take. The first one is that we have a focus on understanding dynamics in neural circuits, and this is what I'll present first. And one of the reasons to care about dynamics is that the world that nervous systems have evolved to operate in is never static. There are constantly perturbations to state of sensory stimuli, for example, that are cause of the evolution of a nervous system and its organization and its principles of functions that must have been adapted to that absence of steady state or constancy. The second aspect is that the brain is a dynamical system. It's formed of populations of neurons, which themselves are dynamical systems. They have capacitance, they have time constants. And therefore, the overall result of these neurons interacting with one another, with synapses that themselves have time constants, and lots of non-linearities, results in complex behavior that unrolls and unfolds over time. And I will argue that it unfolds over time in deterministic fashion, which we have to try and understand. Neural systems and neural networks are rarely at equilibrium. Our basic principles of analysis of activity in the brain is usually based on the idea that we can measure average activities, but this premise, the premise that we can do this, relies on the fact that the system reaches some kind of a steady state, and I'll argue that that's hardly ever the case, and therefore this premise is probably wrong. And I will talk about transient dynamics, which is some kind of dynamics that we generally tend to not study, precisely because it's somewhat difficult to characterize. So it's neither a steady state, not a conventional kind of attractor dynamic, such as a fixed point or a limit cycle, stuff that we can describe reasonably easily. But it's rather a transition between states with non or unstable equilibria in the middle. And so this is the kind of stuff that we'll talk about. And I will make the argument that these transients, in fact, represent attractors themselves, less familiar attractors, but ones that we should care about. And so my goal here is to give you a set of examples that will exemplify or illustrate this idea. The second major aspect about our approach is that it has to do with, or it exploits comparisons across the tree of life and neural systems that come from or have diverged a very long time ago. And so when one studies neural systems or any kind of biological process by caring about evolution, there are several ways to look at it. And the two ways that interest me are the process of looking at inheritance, which provides us with some kind of historical explanation for why things are the way they are. Our ion channels that are expressed in the membranes of our neurons are ones that have a very, very long history. They were actually invented by bacteria way before any neural systems existed. and therefore provide us with some kind of explanation as to why systems are like they are. The components of a postsynaptic compartment at a synapse are found in certain cells or sponges, which have no nervous systems. So the history of life is such that systems of molecules, etc., get hijacked to be used to something, to do something different and something new every time. And there is a lot to be learned from that and from the knowledge of that. The other aspect of evolution, and the reason why I think it's useful, is that there is very strong evidence of convergence, meaning that despite the fact that systems may have evolved through different paths, they generally have had to solve problems which are similar, since the basic constraints of the physics of the world are the same for all organisms. An insect and a vertebrate that wants to fly has to deal with the same kind of fluid dynamics with certain tweaks in parameters, but they have to find solutions to these problems. And those constraints impose constraints on the design of the nervous systems that have to solve them. And the argument that I'd make is that this differentiation between the implementation, which is given by the historical explanation, and the convergence aspect is what allows us to differentiate what is algorithmic from what is implementation detail. And as a systems neuroscientist, this is a thing that really interests me, is to get and dive deep into the principles of functions that are in principle independent of the way you implement them, or the way neural systems have implemented them. So that's the general philosophy, and I'll now dive in three examples to try and illustrate this. I will talk about what I call neural motion, which is dynamics of circuits, and this particular kind I'll describe. And I'll give you three examples, one that is from old work that we have discontinued since, but that I want to present just because it motivates all the rest that we're doing. And that's olfactory work that's done in that was done in insects. So this is the first part. In the second part, I'll talk about a mollusk, about cuttlefish, and they have amazing camouflage behaviors that we've started studying over the past 5 years, and you'll see that they have interesting dynamics as well. And the final example will be from the cortex of reptiles, the reptiles being the only non-mammalian vertebrates, amniotes, that also have a cerebral cortex. So I'll start with insect olfaction, and with this, return to the system that Martin talked about earlier this morning and dive in directly into the response properties of certain neurons in the first relay center of this olfactory system, which is called the antennal lobe. And these neurons that I call projection neurons are the analogs, if you will, functional terms, of the mitral cells in the olfactory bulb of vertebrates. And when we were looking at the responses of these cells, so we're looking at voltage as a function of time. The ticks vertically here are called action potentials. And when we started looking at the responses of these neurons as a function of the stimulus, here is one order, here's a second order, the same neuron in the two cases, we observed that their response patterns are odor specific. You see there's three odor pulses, the neuron responds in the same way. Here's three odor pulses, the neuron responds in the same way. But it responds differently to the two odors. So there's something in the temporal patterning of the response that is odor-specific in a given neuron. Now, if you change neuron, you bring your electrode to a second neuron in that system, you'll find the same thing, except that the patterning of each cell will be different for the same odor. Okay? So that means that the representation of an odor must be carried by a population of cells whose own activities are independent or are in some ways different from one cell to the next. Okay. So that's the first thing, and that's a critical observation that motivated all the rest. If you zoom in on this tiny little part of the response where there are three action potentials, so zoom in there. Record from that cell, in fact you record here in parallel with a second, from a second cell, and record what's called a field potential, which is an average potential from the neighboring region in the brain. What you observe is that the timing of these action potentials is precisely locked to this population activity. And this population activity then allows you to cut up time in time bins, here on the order of 50 milliseconds, that will be the time scale over which that we use to look at the evolution of the system over time. And so now what you can see is that at the first oscillation cycle, the first time bin, cell 1 and cell 2 had an action potential. At the second one, same thing. And at the third one, same thing. At the fourth one, none of the cells were active. So now what you can do is present a variety of different odors. Here are 9 different odors. And look at the pattern of spikes evoked in these 2 cells. And what you observe is that the patterns of spike now are 6 for 9 different odors, meaning that you can, by looking at and caring about the precise timing of the response of each cell across these 2 cells, get much more information than you would just by counting spikes. So the timing and the identity of the spikes matters. We then improved our recording approaches and then could record from populations of 30 up to 100 up to 200 neurons in a population that contains only about 800 of them. So we could have a very good picture of what happens across this population. And to look at the evolution of these vectors of activity, so imagine this is time. Each line is a different cell. There's about 100 in there. And we will cut up time in tiny little windows of 50 milliseconds and measure the state of each one of these neurons in each one of these windows. And we move the window forward. And so at every analysis window, we have basically a binary vector of activity with zeros and ones. And we can think about the representation of the odor as some high-dimensional vector that evolves in that state space. Okay. Now, it's 100 dimensions. It's difficult to see this. So we use dimensionality reduction techniques to try and project this into, in this case, after a PCA, into a principal component state. And we have in there 3 dimensions and a space defined by them in which we can track the evolution of these population vector. And so the system at rest lies in this ball of noise, which is baseline. And when the odor is presented, the system evolves in this way, eventually reaches a fixed point, meaning that it reaches some kind of steady state after a couple of seconds if you leave the odor on. And when you turn the odor off, the system then returns to the baseline state following a transient which is different from the on transient. So we have an on, a baseline, and an off transient. So the representation here is something dynamic that has an on transient, a fixed point, steady state, and an off transient. Okay. So what you can do now is play around with the stimuli. And in this case, we play around with concentrations. And for each one of these lines here, you follow the evolution of these vectors, function of time, for different families of concentrations. The strongest one on the periphery, the weakest one on the center. And you can see that all of them are nested within the others, meaning that they form all together some kind of low-dimensional structure in that state space, where all these representations live, okay? So you can think of this as a stimulus manifold. The representation of an odor is some kind of low-dimensional structure or manifold, surface, if you will, within that high-dimensional space. The representation is a series of vectors that are linked with one another in a deterministic fashion, depending on which stimulus was being presented. Any point on that surface corresponds to a vector of activity, but the response of the population is something that evolves following this path for a given stimulus condition. Okay. So this was done in insect, and for a period of time, Rainer Friedrich was a postdoc with me and was interested in applying the same approaches, applying the same techniques and thinking to zebrafish olfactory bulb. And basically the same description and the same principles apply there, and his lab has continued to study and deepen the understanding of those kinds of representation in a vertebrate system. So you'd say, well, all this is very descriptive, and that's true. But the beautiful thing about insect systems, as Martin was describing earlier this morning, is that you can not only describe what happens, which I did here in this antenna lobe, but you can also look at the decoders of these patterns, meaning you can go directly in the postsynaptic region of the brain, record from cells there, and ask them what they care about in the signals that are represented here. And by doing these experiments, and so we're looking here at cells that are in the mushroom bodies that Martin talked about, they're packed with cells that are called Kenyan cells, we could record from these cells and discover that, in fact, instead of responding to the fixed point, which naively you might have expected, they actually respond only to the dynamic phase or the transient phase of the response, meaning they respond only during the time when their input itself is in motion, not when it has reached steady state. Okay? So the notion that one would use an average firing rate to characterize a response is not appropriate, since there is no steady state when things matter. So how do these cells respond? Well, they respond by having, if you will, in an abstract fashion, a receptive field, which is a tiny little volume within that state space. And this is an experiment here that shows how these cells respond. Here is the population of projection neurons and the trajectory that's defined in response to a particular stimulus. So the blue line here represents the population of projection neurons. We record from a set of Kenyan cells, and this one happens to respond when the blue line, the trajectory of the input, traverses this little volume here. And this is only at that time that this cell produces a few action potentials. So this cell is extremely specific, and it will respond only during a certain window of time during the input trajectory. Okay. If you modify the stimulus slightly in such a way that the input trajectory doesn't traverse, as is the case here, this little region here, the cell doesn't respond anymore. If you shorten the time during which the cell traverses this response volume, then the response of the postsynaptic cell decreases compared to there. In other words, the Kenyan cell itself, this decoder of these patterns, has, if you will, a receptive volume, which is in fact a collection of receptive volumes having to do with the connection matrix of the system, within the state space that is created and formed by the input here, in such a way that their responses are extremely rare. That is, a cell has to traverse a particular region of that volume so as to evoke a single response. And this itself generates a very sparse representation where the cell's responses here are extremely rare and highly specific. Okay? So we're starting to have an understanding of how you form a representation which is specific by exploiting those dynamical features of the response pattern in the system. So through this work, we were able to show that these transient dynamics exist, that they matter, and that the fixed point themselves are not decoded, which is somewhat paradoxical. The fact that something exists when you find it in the brain doesn't necessarily mean that it's exploited directly by the decoding neurons. So now what I'm going to talk about is a completely different system. It's in fact a motor system. And try and explain to you that those also express dynamics that are interesting. So I'm going to show you a video which was taken by Roger Hanlon. So you have a picture here of the bottom of the sea, and I'm going to turn it on. Can hear the voice of Roger Hanlon in that beautiful movie. And what you have here is the solution that these animals have evolved at a certain time during which they suddenly found themselves with vertebrate predators. So these early mollusks had, in very early phases of their evolution, 500 million years ago or before, lost their external shell. And when these predators arose, and they had to find some way of protecting themselves from them, they could have invented a shell again. They didn't. They rather adapted parts of their motor system to create essentially a display system on their skin so as to match the statistics of their environment. So the beautiful thing about these animals is that they don't copy the environment by lying on it, meaning that if you put them on a newspaper, you couldn't read the newspaper on their skin. They rather extract through their eyes some basic statistical features of this environment and reproduce this directly onto their skin. This is an incredibly interesting problem that people who do machine learning and computer vision, for example, have worked on for a very long time. And with deep learning techniques, now you can actually train networks to solve these solutions. But you need hundreds of thousands of training trials before you get a good solution. These animals have them when they hatch out of their egg, meaning that it's embedded in their nervous system, presumably in the connection matrix that is somewhere between the eye and the retina and the output system. So this is one thing that we'd like to find. It involves visual processing, it involves some kind of decision making, and it involves some aspects of motor control. So here you can see a floor of pebbles, the cuttlefish is right there. Here's a different set of colors, and the animal is right there and forms a completely different pattern with these disruptive lines that don't match the outline of the animal itself. If you zoom in here, you can see that the animal makes these little dots that match the sort of little dots you see on the pebbles themselves. They extract certain key features that are sufficient to fool their predators. The other thing that's amazing is that they diverged from us for about 500 to 600 million years ago, meaning that they evolved another system that is completely different from ours. But that's a beautiful instantiation of sort of convergent evolution to solve particular problems, not that of camouflage, of course, but of many other problems, such as locomotion, etc. So I'm going to summarize some technical aspects of what we did to study this system, and that's mainly the work of Sam Ryder, who's a postdoc in the lab, and then get to the dynamics. So the goal that we had is to study the display of this system, which is this array of pigment cells that are called chromatophores, which you can see in action here. You can see them expand and contract, and they do this through the action of a set of radial muscles, about 20 of them per chromatophores, that are controlled by a very small number of motor neurons. And that means that when you look at the state of a given chromatophore, you're indirectly looking at the state of the motor neuron that controls it. And the idea that we had, the goal that we had, was that if we could monitor the state of every single chromatophore on the surface of this animal, we'd indirectly be doing neural imaging of the entire system. Okay? It'd be neural imaging by proxy, in a sense, the way that you do calcium imaging, except in this case, you're just looking at the diameter of these things. So we set out to do this. We have a system here where you can read out the perception of the animal. You don't need to do complicated behavior. You have an input, which is a pattern, which is a 2D pixel array. You have an output, which is another 2D pixel array. And what we'd like to figure out is the transform between them. You have a problem which is computationally incredibly interesting, texture processing. You have this advantage that we can do neural recordings without going into the brain. And as I'll show you, we can actually tackle problems of neural dynamics. So our initial goal was to try and transform this into something like that, where all our images are registered over weeks, months. In fact, at this time, we're trying to do that over an entire year, where we can track every single chromatophore in the animal over these entire periods of time. So I'm just going to illustrate some of these things. So that's the early part of the processing. This is a raw movie where you can see the pattern. This is after one stage of processing where everything has been, in a sense, Botoxed, where the animal and the skin is now, by software, not able to move anymore, except that the variations of diameter of these chromatophores can be tracked. The problem is that every time you change a pattern for the animals moves away, and when it moves away, the movies become blurry, and we cannot really track the chromatophores during that time. So we get sets of images that are separated from others that can be by a few seconds, but they can be by 2 weeks as well, and we have to track them and stitch them together. So that was what took us about 2 years to solve. So we have to stitch these things. So that's an example of one average image for one little bit of movie. Another bit of movie, the animal has changed pattern, so now macroscopically it's not the same anymore, and we have to be able to realign everything and then match these set of chromatophores to those ones. And for this we observe that the distribution of these chromatophores is not crystalline but rather semi-random. It's actually not completely random either, but it's random enough that it forms unique markers that can be thought of as fingerprints, meaning that if you take a small area on the surface of this animal and cross-correlate it with the skin of another time of the same animal, there will be only one match. Okay? So the basic trick is simply to choose a subset, a grid, if you will, of small amounts of pixels, like 64 by 64, and for each one of them, cross-correlate them with all the others on another animal in all translation and rotation possibilities. And then, when you do this, you find matches. Here is the same pattern here in A, there, and you can see the similarity. And this is a 2D correlation between them with a single match. And here is the same thing for the green one, except now the patterns are different, but they're sufficiently overlapping that the correlation is high. So if you compare the correlations that you get in these matches, which you see here on this axis from minus 0.5 to 1, they all lie here, whereas all the non-matches, and there's about 220 million of them here, are all around zero. So we have these unique markers that allow us to match two images together, and we do that pairwise with all the images that we get in the data set, so that we can realign everything all completely. And by doing so, we can go from an image which would be blurry, that's an average of 237,000 images, to something like this, where the pixels are perfectly aligned, and when we can see every single chromatophore. And once we have these single chromatophores over all images aligned, we can actually track their size over time and get time series such as these ones, where we measure the diameter of each one of these chromatophores as a function of its frame. We film at 60 hertz over time, but not only across this particular chromatophore, but all the others that we record in parallel. Okay? Then we get fantastic data sets where we have these time series over tens of thousands of these chromatophores function of time. And now the analysis can start. All that we can do is essentially look at the joint statistics of variation of these elements as a function of time and use them to cluster the data by those that have very high correlations that are presumably controlled by the same motor neurons, which those that have less and less similar correlations, or less and less high correlations, which represents putatively different levels of a hierarchy of motor control. And by doing so, we can actually generate these kinds of hierarchies that from which we can infer a hypothesis about the way in which the nervous system is organized to control them. And by this, we can identify the smallest levels of the hierarchy, which would represent the motor units, and then higher and higher levels of control that form bigger and bigger sets of patterns within that skin. So this is the general approach that we're studying, but now I want to talk about dynamics, and I'll give you an example. This is an animal that's kept, a hand was moved, and the animal suddenly changed pattern within a fraction of a second, and it will return to the dark pattern within about 40 seconds. Okay? So now using the technique I was just describing, we can track every single one of these chromatophores as a function of time. So I'll show you the evolution of a vector of chromatophore sizes, which has 17,000 different elements, projected after PCA into two or three different PCs that account for some fraction of the variance, small but significant. So what you see here is the same thing as what you saw with the olfactory system. You see the evolution of this system as a function of time, as the evolution of a vector of chromatophore sizes projected into these, in this case, two dimensions. So the system started here. A hand is moved, the system evolves to these light patterns, and then it returns slowly to the dark pattern. Then we move the hand again, the system returns there, and every time returns to the dark pattern following the same trajectory. So you'd say it's a projection after PCA in the first two PCs. It doesn't represent necessarily similarity, but you can measure correlations, and you see that every time the correlations are on the order of 0.85 to 9. Meaning that every time the system is returning to its initial state following the same path. So you'd say, well, it's a motor system, and motor systems have certain degrees of freedom, but they have constraints that are physical, that are due to the structure of the plant. If I move an arm, I cannot move it in any kind of way because it doesn't make energetic sense, and some ways are forbidden by the physics of the plant. But here, the chromatophores are individual cells which are independent of their neighbors. In other words, there is no such physical constraint. In the past, the system could go from the light to the dark pattern. It could do that straight in a very simple path. In fact, the system is going through this series of intermediate patterns, which we believe represent the constraints that the structure of the nervous system that controls them imposes on it. So we're reading indirectly something which is very similar to what I was describing earlier, which is the fact that the dynamics of the system are constrained by the internal structure and the connection matrix of the system and the different levels of control that exist within the system that forces it to go through a particular path. And I will argue that on the motor side, this is the flip side of what we're seeing on the olfactory, in the olfactory system. We're looking at the evolution of a neural state following a very deterministic path that's imposed by the structure of the system. Okay. So that's the second system, and I'm now going to go to the third one, which is a vertebrate cortex, and which will potentially give us some mechanistic ideas about what causes these very deterministic pathways. So we're going to look at the cerebral cortex of turtles, and I'll first introduce Mike Hamburger, who's a grad student in the lab, finishing now, who has done nearly all of the experiments I'm going to show. But before that, I want to introduce the cortex itself, that is a structure which exists across all reptiles, which is similar to the old cortices that we find in mammals, meaning the piriform cortex and the hippocampal formation, which is a three-layered structure. Three layers means, in fact, one cell layer, which is layer two. And a lot of work has been done over the past decades and so on about trying to understand the common, the homologies, if you will, between mammalian and reptilian brain. And the work that we did recently that was done mainly by Maria Toskes, who's a wonderful postdoc in the lab, using RNA-seq, single-cell RNA-seq on this system, was to try and identify similarities between mammalian and other systems and reptilian cortex. And this is a complicated slide that I'm not going to go through, just to tell you that the experiments I'm going to show you are ones that were made on this part of the cortex, which we call the dorsal cortex, which from a transcriptomic point of view is the closest that we have to the neocortex, six-layer cortex of a mammalian brain. Okay. So the turtles and the reptiles in general have a great advantage for experimentalists in that they can essentially survive outside of the animal. We can take the brain out of the animal. We can actually cut a large piece of cortex and keep it alive for a few days, even put it in the fridge at night to go back home. And here's an experiment, or the design of the experiments, where we take the cortex here. You see a cross-section of the brain there. We can unfold this cortex and lay it against an array of, a 2D array of microelectrodes, called MIA, microelectrode array, from which we can record hundreds of neurons at the same time. And by combining this with patch clamp recordings from single pyramidal cells, we can evoke activity within one cell and study what happens in the cortex as a consequence of that very simple manipulation. Okay? So the experiments I'm going to show you are of that nature. We can also, using tricks of data analysis, distinguish excitatory from inhibitory neurons from the extracellular recordings that we get. So a typical experiment goes like this. Mike patches a cell, injects a pulse of current, makes that cell fire, and with the MIA, record from 400 to 800 different neurons within that cortex, surrounding that thing, over a square millimeter of cortex. And what you can see in this very simple display here is that after the production of two action potentials, this cell is hyperpolarized. And you can repeat the pulse many times, and systematically that cell is hyperpolarized. And it's hyperpolarized by synaptic potentials, IPSPs, which means that they must be caused by interneurons that have been activated, meaning that, these two spikes in that single cell are sufficient to activate part of the network. And indeed, we can record that network, and we can see that many cells are activated by these single spikes, and some of them are actually the cause of these IPSPs. We can show them and show that directly through typical tricks of electrophysiology. So we're going to follow and look at the state of some of those cells that are activated by a couple of spikes in one pyramidal cell. So here is a set of about 14 of them. And these are the two spikes that have been evoked by intracellular injection of current in that patch cell. And what I'm going to do here is simply reorder these spikes by the time at which they've been created. So by reordering, now we get some kind of a sequence of activation. Okay. Now what I'm going to do is to keep the order in which, the rank order in which these cells are displayed, and show you many other trials of the same experiment. And this is what you see. You have now 10 different trials, and you can see that systematically you get a similar sequence of activation of these cells. Each cell is activated in a particular window of time, which is very narrow, and then the second cell is activated a little later, and the third one, and the fourth one, etc. So what we have is the expression of the action of a single neuron activating a piece of circuitry in such a way that you get a deterministic chain of activation from neuron 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, etc. And each sequence is specific to that cell and to the condition of activations. So here's a set of examples. This is one single spike evoking activation in a group of followers. Inject a little longer pulse of current so as to get two spikes, and you get more cells activated, again forming some kind of a sequence. Another example, examples with 16 follower cells, an example with 33 follower cells, and here a summary diagram of many of these experiments where we get for 34 experiments nearly 300 cells whose action and activation unfolds over 200 milliseconds. Okay? So here we have the expression of the influence of a single cell on a network, which is not random. It activates a specific subset of neurons and activates them in a specific sequence. So the thing that was, one thing that intrigued us was the fact that there is this sort of quantization of responses. If you see, if you bin all these spikes, you can see that they form very narrow modes of activation here. And we decided to look at that in more detail by doing multiple patch recordings from the same slabs of cortex. And here is an example of a set of experiments that Mike did, where he records from three cells in this case, one which is the one from which an action potential is generated, and then one here and one there. So this one here is activated, you can see an EPSP, after about a millisecond. This one is activated after 3 milliseconds, but you see a second EPSP about 6 milliseconds later still. Yet this cell has fired only once, not twice, so that means that in between this and that has to be another cell that has been activated. And here's a set of other examples where you can see these polysynaptic PSPs, the ones that occur at delays longer than 2 or 3 milliseconds. This one, that one, that one, that one. No first EPSP. You have a delay of 10 milliseconds before you get a reliable PSP. Meaning that there are very reliable polysynaptic pathways that enable the flow of information through the network following a single action potential. And if you bin the onset time of these EPSPs, as is done here, you can see that it forms this multimodal distribution that matches the one that we saw also for the spikes, meaning that we have the potential explanation for this. One cell activates another one, in fact, activates many other ones, which themselves, after some delay, which is both synaptic and integration delay, will activate another set, etc. And this population then evolves as a result of this simple single-cell activation. For this to be true, the gain of certain synapses would have to be very high. So we looked at the distribution of synaptic strength across the population, and here is a typical example of this, where you can see this long-tail distribution with a small number of very powerful synapses made by every neuron. So across the thousands of outputs that a given cell makes, it makes a small subset of very powerful ones that are sufficient to trigger the system and its evolution. If what I'm telling you is true, one should observe something which is predicted by people having studied this through simulations, which is that the jitter of the onset of the cells should increase as the delay increases. And that is indeed the case. If you plot the jitter here, as a function of the delay to the onset, you can see that there is clearly a positive relationship here with an increase. But you can see that certain cells, which are the ones with the dot in the middle of the circle here, keep a very small jitter even with delays of 150 milliseconds. So you have cells which are extremely reliably activated even 100 milliseconds later through a polysynaptic pathway, implying that there exists within this system sets of highly reliable synapses that can reach a cell several hundred milliseconds later, which is remarkable. How does it occur spatially? Well, I was telling you we record with these 2D arrays of electrodes, so here is less than a square millimeter of this, and we can look at the activation of these cells as a function of time, and we can follow the evolution of these vectors of activity as a function of time. Here is one trial, another trial, three trials together, and you can see that systematically you activate the same chain of neurons time after time. And if you do that over many preparations, you can see that each one of them will generate its own chain that goes in a particular direction. You can do even more, to my personal eyes, beautiful experiments where you patch two cells and start a chain from those two cells, either by stimulating cell one alone or cell two alone, or the two of them together, either with a zero delay or some time delay between them, and see what happens when you do this. So here's an experiment that again, Mike did, where he stimulates cell one alone, he gets three followers. Cell two alone, he gets about 10 different followers. You can see that cell two inhibits cell one, although it's a pyramidal cell, so it's the indirect expression of some interneurons being in between. And now he's going to stimulate both of those cells, first with zero delay between them, and he gets some new pattern of followers. Then with a delay such that cell two precedes cell one by 10 milliseconds, and he gets a new set of followers. And now the converse, well, one precedes two, and these followers are now silenced, but a new set of followers is activated. Meaning that the identity of the cells that are activated by these patterns depend not only on the identity of the cells that are the cause of this, but also the order in which they're activated. So you can imagine the combinatorial capacity of a system such as this, where you can suddenly potentially encode a pattern of spiking of two cells into some kind of trajectory across the population. So to summarize, what I've shown you here is something like this, where when you stimulate a single cell within this cortical structure, this causes the activation of many other cells in a deterministic manner that is a consequence of the internal connectivity of the system that can unfold over hundreds of milliseconds, over tens of cells, and we undersample the system by many fold for the projection for the pyramidal cells, meaning that this thing must actually occupy far many more cells than we actually sample. And this activity, of course, is not carried by single cells, but as soon as you've triggered the system, it diverges to a bunch of cells, pyramidal cells and interneurons, which all interact with one another in a particular way that's dependent on the way in which they're connected. Meaning that these patterns here are, in principle, exactly the analog of the stuff I was telling you about for the olfactory system or for the motor system of these cuttlefish. You're looking at vectors of activity across a population of neurons that evolve in a deterministic fashion over time in the network. And what I'll argue here is that we may be looking at three different examples at three different levels of the similar kind of principle of evolution of activity and of dynamics within a neural network. Now, why would that be interesting? Well, there are theoretical reasons why it's interesting, because people have studied these kinds of principles, such as Moshe Abeles, for example, for a long time in an idea that he calls a synfar chain or synfar braid. Eli Bienenstock has studied this as well, and Eugene Izhikevich is looking at that as well. So there's a small theoretical field that's been very interested in this, but for which there's been very little experimental support so far. But there's a lot of experimental work that suggests that that might be relevant to it. And one of them is the idea of replay and even preplay in the hippocampal formation of mammals, where you have these chains of activation that are in principle the fast replay of past experience of populations of play cells within area C01 of rodent hippocampus. You have also examples of birdsong and specific nuclei within the brain of birdsong, such as HVC, which has neurons whose responses or whose activity is extremely sparse, but form sequences of activity that are learned as the animal learns its song, which are very similar in their unfolding to the stuff that I was describing to you in the cortex. And of course, the hippocampal formation is, from the point of view of evolution of brain structure, very close to the reptilian cortex. They presumably all evolve from a common ancestor cortex that existed about 320 million years ago in their common ancestor and that had the same structure. So I will say that these things may be expressions of the stuff that I was describing first in this olfactory system. We have examples in leeches from the work of Kevin Brickman. And now in the past 10 years or so, we have a lot of examples coming from study of motor cortex of primates, where we see this sort of unfolding of sequences of activation within motor and premotor cortex, even in the absence of the expression of the motor action itself, often preceding it. So I've shown you this, that there exists reliable deterministic neural population dynamics in three different systems that I described. These dynamical phases can coexist with steady states, as I showed you for the olfactory example, but the transients are the relevant phases. The reason why there is a steady state is something we can discuss, but is not obviously is not totally obvious when looking at it. These transients live on low-dimensional manifolds that can be described, and that presumably, and that's a guess at this point, are a result of the connectivity of all these neurons in the system. And then in the case of these reptilian cortex, I showed you that a single or a couple of action potential in a single pyramidal cell is sufficient to generate a sequence of activation across tens of different neurons, excitatory and inhibitory neurons. And this is something I didn't show you, but there's a sort of balancing of activity across the system such that activity doesn't explode. So to finish, I'll tell you that my message, that this kind of neural dynamics might be the expression of something which is a general principle, something that I would love to demonstrate and prove. And I will make the argument that using comparisons across different model systems is one way to get at that. And to finish, I want to thank and recognize the amazing contribution of fantastic group of people. Sam did the work with a bunch of others on the cephalopod chromatophore system. Mike did the work on the reptilian cortex, aided by Mark Schein-Idelsen and Lorenz Palmer. And Maria Tosques did the transcriptomics work. Thank you very much.